Welcome to Visionaries. I'm your host, Jacob Wolf, an award-winning investigative journalist and the CEO and founder of Overcome. We have a dynamite of an interview for you tonight. We are coming to you with an interview with Alban Deschelette, the CEO of G2 Esports, who has a very, very tough challenge to take G2 to the next level. If you can't tell, we've been watching a lot of wrestling recently. Those were both WWE and AEW references. Nonetheless, this was a fantastic interview. It was a very candid interview and a tough interview. If you've listened to this show over the past year, you have gotten to see kind of behind the curtain. So much of my work over the past 7-8 years has been the answers people have given me, not the questions that I have asked. And if you've listened to the Alan Benet interview and you've listened to the Ben Brode interview and some of the others, you'll hear when I put tough questions in front of people and you get to hear how they react to those in real time with all the breaths and all the noises, etc. This is a hard one, and I really respect Alban coming on the show. You know, for a little bit of context before I open the floor to Prame to give his thoughts as usual, we told Alban that this was going to be a little bit tougher. We gave a topic list of that we were going to be talking about. Some of the things we talked about here, we never provide questions, but we did give a topic list so he wasn't blindsided, to be respectful to him. And if you're unfamiliar with what's going on here, G2 Esports is the most relevant team in all of esports in Europe. They are trying to become more and more global. They have been doing so with teams. They were trying to make a very big expansion into America pre-pandemic, looking to relocate their headquarters from Berlin to New York. And obviously the COVID-19 pandemic sidebred that. But in the past year, their founder and former CEO, Carlos Rodriguez, known as Ocelot, was videotaped in a nightclub with Andrew Tate, the misogynistic influencer. And the uproar that happened after that video found itself in social media led to Rodriguez resigning because so many people were upset. Andrew Tate is very much persona non grata among gaming fans and many people on the internet for legitimate reasons. So accused of human trafficking, among other things. And instead of walking away from it, Carlos's reaction was to own it and to double down and say that that's his friend and that he can be friends with whoever the fuck he wants. And ultimately that led to him. Alban says that it was a voluntary resignation. He resigned from the position, and Alban, his right-hand man, was tasked with coming in and righting the ship and figuring out what this team is without its front man that it has had for the past decade. It's a very hard challenge. Prem, what did you think of the interview with Alban?
I think a few things. One, the voluntary stepping down kind of feels like the CEO of Unity who just stepped down. There's no chance that it was just like, I don't feel like doing it anymore. I'm like, I did make mistakes. So I'm going to leave. No. In both cases, I can bet you money. Boards or stock reflected the remarkably negative sentiment of the decisions made. And someone said, hey, you got to go. But that aside, this interview, like we said, it's something that we wanted to do, like very candidly. We were trying to get this interview soon after the G2 issues with Carlos. And understandably, G2 was not interested in doing that. I think they had to a little bit of what we would call soul searching, but I think it's understanding what moves to make. So that single terrible action and terrible set of decisions doesn't upend the whole company. So in that respect, I do want to like genuinely shout out G2 for both Alban and the team for being willing to come here, because like it's not a secret that you're going to ask hard questions.
No, it's an expectation. It's an expectation from our audience. It's an expectation from our interviewees. We always try to do a really good job of being journalistically responsible, not providing questions, because journalists should not do that prior to, you'd never provide the questions, but you can provide a topic and you can give a little bit of a guideline. I never want anybody to feel that they've come on this show and been gotcha'd. That's not the point. I want everyone to know they're coming on this show, and this is going to be an honest and deep discussion about very difficult topics. And Carlos wasn't the only one we addressed in this episode as well. And again, I immense amount of respect for Albon and for the team at G2 that got him here for showing up and being cordial, being respectful. We disagreed at some points and he said verbatim, like, I respect your opinion and the opinion that you hold, that's your opinion. And, you know, you're allowed to believe what you want to believe. And on that note, kind of one of the other topics that we covered really substantially towards the end of the show that you'll hear is talking about Saudi Arabia. Past topic in this show, it's, you know, the Saudi Arabian state and their public investment fund has been extremely aggressive at acquiring companies in the gaming space, ESL, Faceit, Esports Engine, etc. And I made a prediction, and I believe this to be true, that there will be a major esports team with a significant stakeholdership by the Saudi Arabian government in probably the next 6 to 8 months. And I asked Albon, bold-faced, and why I asked him is because you'll hear me say it in the preamble, he did a deal during his time of working at Riot Games. He did a deal with NEOM for the LEC, and NEOM is the Saudi Arabian tourist like city that they are building on indigenous land and pushing out indigenous people to build on top of it. It is extremely controversial. Saudi Arabia is also extremely controversial because they have a terrible human rights track record when it comes to dealing with folks who are LGBTQ. And so I asked him boldface, like, is G2, if G2 got an acquisition offer from the Saudi Arabian state tomorrow, would you take it if you could make that decision yourself? And he walked around the answer a little bit, but he at least took it in the face. You know, I, as a journalist, the Jamal Khashoggi thing feels very, very personal. I wear that bias hard on the sleeve. I don't think it's a bad bias to hold to feel like a government's going to kill you. But, you know, all that to say, it was a tough interview. He was a good sport. I appreciated him being a good sport.
We can jump into the interview in a sec here, but I do want to, separate from this G2 discussion, talk about a potential major org being effectively majority owned by Saudi. I think that you're right in that it's going to happen pretty soon, but I think we should address why we think that. This year has seen like a 60% drop in external investments in the gaming industry. I'd need to find the numbers exactly, but I think it was like 2.1 billion to less than 700 million. That is for gaming at large. But esports has seen an even kind of sharper decline because esports has been carried pretty unsustainably. And I think that there are a few orgs that are either already desperate to have some money that keeps them afloat or are a couple steps away. At some point, I think that need to survive is going to lead, my prediction is FaZe Clan, frankly, to become a Saudi majority owned team. It'd be one thing if that investment was, and it almost definitely will be, from the public investment fund. It's not going to be some just altruist. And for a team to be effectively owned by a state in that sense is concerning, I think. I think that's fair to say.
I agree. And I don't think it'll be FaZe, but I do think it will be a major player in the space. I wouldn't say something like that without hearing some rumblings. So I do want to dive into the interview. Before we get into it, reminder, we have a Patreon. There, we got a note from somebody who listened to the show that basically said that Visionaries has gotten them more into gaming, more into esports because of our episodes, because I found our show just in general. That's the point. That's what we're doing here. We're trying to get gaming and esports to be more accessible for people and to make this entire industry easier to understand, better to understand from a conceptual perspective, while digging into the weeds at the same time. I love hearing that feedback from people. Thank you very much to the person that sent us that note. It really did make our day, made our week. So we will dive into this interview, but if you want to support the work we are doing here, we greatly appreciate it. It does really matter. We are building something from the ground up. Please do so over on our Patreon. It's going to be linked in the show notes. As always, you can click through in the show notes and then go over to the Patreon and subscribe. There's a plethora of benefits, as we've talked about before, including being able to listen to these shows live in our Discord. We do have a free tier. You can come participate in the Discord. But if you pay for it, you can also come ask questions to the people on the show. And so we are constantly having a lot of people on the show that are really, really high profile, like Albon, like others. We want to be able to take questions from our audience. So please sign up for the Patreon. If you sign up in the next few weeks before the end of the month, you get a price lock at $7 a month for the next year. You also get a nice little founder medallion token from us at the beginning of next year if you stay signed up through the end of the year. We're really excited. We've seen a lot of success with this. Thank you all so, so, so much for listening to the show. And here is our interview with Albon Dechelet. Albon Dechelet, welcome to Visionaries.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
So I want to kind of start, we always start kind of the show because we have a lot of different listeners that come from, you know, nerd culture and the creator space, et cetera. Give people kind of a quick overview of what G2 Esports is today and how it got here.
Sure. It's a relatively young organization. We are 8 years old. We have roughly 150 employees and players combined. And we play in 7 different games with 11 teams. So we are like a relatively big esports organization. What makes us special is that we're not German, we're not Spanish. Nowadays, we are more and more American. So we are very international. We have a big on competition, and the competitive spirit of G2 is kind of renowned now. But at the same time, we have a very specific tone of voice, and we don't take ourselves too seriously in the way we tell stories and go through the competition.
In terms of where you think that the organization is right now in its history and where you are headed, I think that's one of the most interesting things about G2 right now. As I remember prior to the pandemic, you know, San Carlos in New York, et cetera, it was clear to me that the organization wanted to sort of move into being more American and moving to the States, et cetera. And I don't think that's come as maybe much to fruition as one might have thought 3 years ago. What is the future of the organization here today?
So I think we are going to the, you know, the first phase of G2. First phase when Jens and Carlos created G2 was to create like a operational esports organization, building teams that wins and create content that engage. That phase, you know, went from the beginning to the moment they entered the LEC. That was the moment where they started to staff kind of like marketing, commercial, building the operations, making this product a business that it sounds. And I think we have been profitable for the last 2 years. So we had this moment where not just a product that fans likes, it's actually a business that is sounded. And now we're in this third phase. We're like, okay, now we know how to operate this and to make it like a sound business. Want to expand. And for us, the expansion is, you know, new games, but also an opportunity to expand a new region. As I mentioned, we have kind of like this very special humor, tone of voice that people like from LA to Shanghai through Berlin. But the reality is that we mostly have teams in Europe. So want to correct that. Want to add some few rosters with like entertaining and performing players that's fans in the US, but also fans in Asia we want to cheer for.
How many G2 esports fans are there today, do you think? And I'm asking that because I want something that's more than just a Twitter follower count or something of the sort.
Yeah, this is the norm, is to combine the, I think it's like at this stage 35 million followers if you combine everything. But this is wrong, and everyone knows it, because if you are followers on Twitter, you probably follow on Instagram. But you count it twice, you know. That's the kind of like the mystery of like people compares like Apple and peers. I would say between 5 and 10 million, depending of how you deduplicate the data. It's very difficult, for example, to compare platforms that are not owned by Meta with others. It's very complicated to evaluate the numbers of real unique followers we have in China. But I would be surprised if it would be below 5, and I think 10 million is probably the highest level in terms of uniques.
Well, and I think part of the hard thing is that you can't just like having followers, having people who are interested in your team or your brand is not the same as someone who's like truly a fan, right? I follow G2. I'm not a fan of G2. I'm not a fan of any esports team, to be clear. I'm not dissing you guys. No, I'm just saying I'm not a fan of any of these teams. I've seen under the curtain enough to know that like everyone has their issues. And I like don't like at this point, just like don't. Yeah. Journalists shouldn't be fans in general. So, yeah, stay neutral. Don't have affinities.
So we started to create like a G2 army, which is kind of like this super fan, like basically service that we provide to the fans that wants to engage with us, not only online, but wants to attend events, get some tickets, get access to exclusive content. So we are trying to figure out kind of like this like cohort and bring them more value for being such amazing fans for us. But I don't have an exact number. It's interesting for us to see that normally when a fan starts with G2, it's probably because they like a players or they like a game, and we have a roster in this game. The big challenge that we all have as an organization in esports is to convince them that they should care about the organization, not just the roster and not just the players. I think we have seen with like great players joining us, but also sometimes leaving us, like Jankos or Reckless or people like that, that we managed to not only, you know, have some new fans joining us, but also staying with us. And when we had like rosters in like Gozen or recently Barrent, we see that we are able to, you know, give them a flair of what the G2 way is. But that's the challenge. The biggest challenge is to make sure they care beyond the players of a roster they started to follow you.
Well, that's exactly. We've talked about that before on the show, which is, what are they a fan of? And I think this has been the biggest challenge for esports teams in general, has been that esports teams get fans. TLO was here 2 weeks ago, the new, you know, the GM of Shopify Rebellion. And one of the things we were talking about is how you build fandom for an esports team when the community is so player driven in a way that I think way more than traditional sports, probably most comparable to soccer or football or basketball in particular, where people like to follow players and transition. You know, the example I always use is there are a lot of people who have been Los Angeles Lakers, Cleveland Cavaliers, and Miami Heat fans over the past 15 years. That's because they love LeBron James, and that's been his transition throughout his career from team to team. And so there are people that follow players, and then there are people that just like bandwagon, right? And they like the winning team, and so you have to win. And in esports historically, especially the past 5 to 6 years, that's meant spending millions of dollars on rosters. It's a little less aggressive than spending in Europe, but how do you build fandom that is a fan of this brand? And I have a follow up to this after that is of the brand and not of a player and doesn't solely bank on G2 winning all the time.
Look, we try to have a unique brand proposition. We don't just try to rely on winning. This has been articulated about like a certain way to do banter. You probably heard about some of our fedam in this area. It's around the way we introduce our partners. We're not shy to entertain with our partners and not on the side of, you know, one side is entertainment, the other side is sponsorship. We kind of blur the lines of that and we engage our sponsors in very like the integral part of the content of G2. And we try to create some storylines. I think, you know, there is kind of like a secret sauce that we try to push in thinking everything we do as like a tragedy or a story arc. And there's a reason why if you look at the different roster we have, you can clearly identify some archetypes. You know, there's Monesi, there's Yike, there's like Uxie, there's like Jankos. We have some superstar hero. We have some prodigy, we have some water carrier that we replicate into a structure of all rosters to try to create some bridges and some story arc that our fans can find when they follow us in different games in a way that we believe contribute to, you know, blur the lines and create the bridges between the different stories of our different rosters under the roof and the very specific way of entertaining that G2 is trying to carry. I usually say that there's one roster at G2 that never disappoint. It's our content team. It's also because it's our biggest team. You know, it's the team that we invest the most in terms of resource. I think last year we had like something like 450 videos. I don't think a lot of teams have done as much in this area. And we believe that this is one of the big things that differentiate us in building this fandom that you are referencing.
What's interesting about that is that up until about a year ago, a lot of your organization was built around Carlos, around Ocelot. And obviously, he was ousted from the organization as a result of associations and public associations with Andrew Tate, the misogynistic influencer online. And I think one of the more confounding things for me in the history of esports is the CEO influencer. And it wasn't just him, be it Jack Etienne at Cloud9, be it Reginald at TSM, the Hotshot GG, Steve Aarons at Team Liquid, etc., where granted with Reginald and with Carlos, they're both ex players. So they, you know, there's a little bit there, but I've never quite understood. And we saw this with Nicole Point Jameson at Evil Geniuses most recently, why the CEO wants to be a public personality. And it puts you in this very precarious position that I think you all have found yourself in the past year. Is he was such an identity of the brand. He's still an owner on the cap table, even if not actively involved. So what is G2 without Carlos Rodriguez?
I mean, first of all, Carlos and Jens founded G2, so they created the brand, they created the legacy. There's a lot of things that we capitalize on today that has been founded by both of them. So it was a massive transition for us. We had someone that was very legitimate because of his role in the foundation of the company, very popular, and also quite available to create some content. So it was very easy for us to use him as a main character if you talk about storytelling. But now, I think 1 year later, almost, or a bit more now, we are very happy with the transition. I think now we have been able to put forward like the level of diversity and the international collective that G2 represents with all the players, all the actors that we have in the different rosters, give us much more flexibility in the way we can create content from the different region where we operate. And we are less dependent of one individual. So for sure, it has been a brutal transition. I think the week after the incident was very difficult for us because we had to reinvent a lot of the way we were operating. But at the same time, I feel like right now, G2 is very strong. We've proven that we can have some high level of performance in terms of like competitiveness. We have some great personality that revealed themselves and took the stage and took us to very interesting directions in terms of like expressing the G2 organization. And our partners, both publishers and sponsors, supported us in the transition and now pushing us forward. I didn't get your answer on the leadership. So on the leadership, I mean, it's not a secret that I didn't try to replace Carlos. I took over his role as a CEO, but we identified clearly that would have been very difficult and also not super, from my point of view, the best solution for G2 to try to have a replacement for Carlos. It's impossible to replace the founder, what Carlos has done and everything. So we came up with another strategy, which was to have the collective take the first stage. And in a way, I don't feel personally the need to be famous. I don't feel the need to be popular. If anything, I feel the need to be responsible for supporting the talent and the people from G2 to be their best work. And that's what I focus on instead of like spending a lot of time on content.
We never got the real answer as to why he was ousted. And I have heard, you know, that the video of him in a nightclub with Andrew Tate was directly linked to the fact that G2 did not make Valorant last year and that they were not accepted into Valorant as an organization. Is that why he was ousted?
I mean, first of all, he resigned. So it's not true to say he was ousted. In fact, that we never had a board meeting where we voted against Carlos or a shareholders resolution where we asked them to vote against Carlos leaving. And you know, you can be angry of what he did if you disagree with anything he did. But I think you have to respect that he took the decision to leave, considering that G2 was more important than his personal situation in this case. So I want to call it out. He resigned from all active position. As a founder, he lost all his founding rights. As a member of the board, he resigned without any compensation. And as an employee or managing director, because it's a very special status in Germany, just resigned without any compensation. So that's what he did. Probably considering that what happened was very disturbing for the fans, for the partners, for the publishers around G2, even for the employees. And any other solution would have been difficult, but he took the decision. On the second part of your question, I cannot confirm, I cannot deny that G2 was on the list and at the end we didn't make it in the VCT, but I would just say that from my point of view, we were very, very, very disappointed not to be part of the league. And on the other side, also based on my personal experience of working for Riot before joining G2, I understand the decision if Riot took the decision not to take us, because it's very important to put the interest of the league, of the collective, of the game above any organization. And if they consider that picking us would have put a bad light on their new league, then I understand why they took the decision.
I hear you on the fact that from a formality perspective, he may not have been pushed out and that he actively chose to resign. Even the narrative that he is publicly spinning now, and I do want to ask you a little bit about that, given the fact he's still on the cap table, is that he was quote unquote canceled and forced out of his company and, you know, going from canceled to billionaire. Like, this is the type of language he's actively using. And so certainly I think his narrative is that he is pushed out of his baby because, you know, people don't agree with Andrew Tate and his views on women and minorities and other things.
I fundamentally believe that sports organization, and I consider G2 as a sports organization, by the way, are only formally owned by investors. End of the day, the people we are like giving the control or giving, like, we are responding in terms of responsibility are the fans. And so I feel that the fans have been overly negative after what happened. And in a way, he took his responsibility of saying, I accept that majority or a significant amount of the fans were not happy with Carlos staying and expressed their distrust in what happened. And therefore, he was canceled. I don't know if he was canceled, but he was pushed by the reaction of our fans, which are very important stakeholders in the organization.
How do you feel, you know, because he's still a part of the brand and its legacy, even if he's not actively participating in an executive or board role? How do you feel about the way that he is behaving publicly now?
Look, he has his own life, his own project on the way to become billionaire, as you call it out. We have to respect that, you know, he has the right to choose his destiny for the next adventure. Right now, don't interact with him more than any other shareholders. He put his shares into a trust in order to isolate his participation in the cap table. And he's not active in, neither influence the decision of a board of the organization. So I, on one side, I respect his decision to resign. And I think it was a big decision from himself to let go G2 to protect it. But on the other side, I also accept that, you know, he has the second life of his career that he wants to build, and we have to let him do it, you know, and encourage him to build his next adventure.
Do you feel it's genuine or no?
That he's going to become billionaire? I've learned never to undermine G2.
I mean, the entire thing. I think this is way more common in America than it is in Europe and elsewhere. But I mean, the sort of grift to become something else is certainly a very common thing. And I'm curious how much you think that is genuine or not. This is someone that, you know, recruited you to work at the company.
Yeah, I mean, like, what I can tell you is that I was talking to him like several hours per day when he was the CEO, and he was involved with every single decision, you know. And the week after, he was not involved in anything. And since he resigned, he stood to his words of not getting involved in any decision. It was kind of like a bit weird for us in the first off season of League of Legends not to have Carlos involved at all. But it's the truth. So he's moving to the second life of his career. You know?
How much of G2 does he own today, or the trust that he established in?
So as you can check on the register in Berlin, he owns 29.7% of the company right now. And obviously, G2 and him discussing and trying to find investors that would want to ever help us grow G2, which will mechanically dilute his ownership, or potentially on the long term, acquire a portion of his ownership. There's no intention for him to come back or never participate in the concession of G2 in the future.
I want to talk about the that part of esports now, because we've talked about it on the show, which is fundraising and expectations. I think that this is, again, I think the European organizations, I've said this before, were a lot better about this than the American ones. But I think the problem with esports is not that it can't be something significant and that there isn't potential for it to one day be as big as, you know, other traditional sports, be it football, American or global football or basketball or baseball. I think the problem is that a lot of the salesmanship around esports on its come up was far too fast. It was far too ambitious, and the expectations exceeded the reality. And we see a lot of organizations suffering from that now that they can't find new means of capital, et cetera. What are your thoughts about building sort of what people in the American investment community call a default alive business? And basically where you don't have to worry about what the next funding, you know, what the next loan is, what the next investment is, et cetera. How do you do that with a modern day esports organization?
Let's go back in time a little bit. Before free-to-play, publishers' interest and esports ecosystem interest were not super aligned, because esports is not particularly driving recruitment historically, and the publisher were very focused on launching the next game but not retaining their community. Enter free-to-play, suddenly esports become the meta. Like, this is the thing that will low loyalty, retention for a community for a game that you want to serve as a service and not as a product anymore. That created an excitement that probably overheated it a little bit, let's put it this way, with things such as a new genre like Battle Royale that create a massive influx into a level where gaming become mainstream. Combine all this, and then you have publishers saying people willing to finance their meta game, you know, and projects such as Franchise, where they want to keep the control, but they want people to fund it, you know. So that generated inflation of salary, investment into franchise fee, significantly increased the production cost for marginal added value in the business, prize money, which we know has no value at all for this ecosystem, and overall, a lot of love capital into teams. Probably a bit too much capital for what they could execute. Probably a bit too much teams compared to what the market can absorb, you know? So right now, I think just a time of consolidation. We'll see probably 5 to 10 global teams that will become very, very successful, very, very profitable. And we'll have in major region, major games, 5 to 10 local heroes, specialized heroes. They also will be very profitable with a very small size. Right now, the challenge is in the middle, and the team in the middle would probably suffer a lot. I believe in esports. I believe in the core business of esports, which is like competition, partners with publishing sponsors, and storytelling in between. I don't believe in creators' economy as the must-win battle for esports. I don't believe in creating a soft drinks or a keyboards company. I believe this is a great business to be part of, but we have to execute it at the right scale, at the right speed, and also finding a balance between going global or going local, but not trying to be skewed in the middle.
You're saying we're not going to see a G2 energy anytime soon.
We're very happy with Red Bull. Thank you.
How do you monetize those fans to build consistent revenue streams, though? Because you mentioned the membership service that you guys are offering. We've seen others do the same, Fnatic, Team Liquid, etc. I'm curious how you think about the total addressable market, the amount of actual people that you can, and the total market that you can acquire for something like that. and how you make it big enough to support this business that is spending millions of dollars a month, because that's the reality of most of them. How do you get to that point where it, you know, you build consistent revenue streams that aren't sponsorship, et cetera, because we do see advertising changing to more CPA, et cetera, less CPM. It's less good faith, but like a lot of it now, advertisers are getting a little bit more wise and a little bit more strict about digital advertising.
We like great advertisers that do great campaigns. We don't see that as a bad thing. So right now, roughly 60% of our revenue comes from brands, 30% comes from publishers, and 10% directly from fans. So to answer directly your first question, it's a marginal part of our revenues. Interestingly, we probably generate four times more revenues from our virtual goods than from our physical goods. So the skins that we, which we share revenue from the publishers from, generate four times more revenues than our Ralph Lauren polo or jerseys, which is already an indication of like where the future could take us, you know, in terms of like monetizing our fans directly, but not necessarily with like solution from the past or from the traditional sports. End of the day, I fundamentally believe that it's up to us to create the product and services that create enough value for our fans that they are ready to pay for it and be satisfied after paying for it. And that's just a call for innovation. That's a call for throwing spaghetti in the wall, testing things, learning. I heard a lot of people complaining about NFT. We did an NFT. And guess what? We're still feeding the value of this NFT because we believe that we have not yet reach enough value for our fans who bought it to be satisfied. So while everybody like took the cash and ran after it, we're actually still like running some activity and initiative. And I don't want to spoil anything, but we are working on adding value to existing NFT just because we believe in that. This idea of like creating value for people wants to buy, but also are satisfied after. And when I think about, so I come from traditional sports. I work 10 years in football. I was myself a rugby player. We don't have a stadium. And I don't believe we'll have a stadium, by the way. I know Kekop and Kamel just announced a stadium in France for the team. I don't think that's our model, also because we are not French or German. We have this become of international. So it would be very difficult to have a stadium everywhere by definition. But I believe we'll have a virtual stadium one day. Every year, there's a new idea about how this virtual stadium could exist. I heard about something called Metaverse last year. Apparently, it's dead now. But we'll find a solution to create value. Today is a Discord, honestly. Maybe yesterday was Discord, today is an app. And I believe this is the way. Like, we will find this, like, interconnected space where we can create value for our fans. Maybe it's going to be multi-local. Maybe it's going to be virtual. But that's the kind of innovation we're looking for in this direct to fans. Is it going to be 50% of our revenue right now? I don't think so. But if you look at existing business model of like traditional sports, I mean, they usually talk about 40-40-20, 40% from brand, 40% from media, 20% from the fans directly. I believe we can reach that. We have to boost a little bit the publishers who, for me, are the media of traditional sports. We have to boost a little bit like direct to fans by innovating and finding new solution to a very specialized and different community than a football community, and keep delivering value to our sponsors so that they want to carry on with us.
There's a lot to pick at there. I want to start with the, because I know this has been a part of the sort of G2 brand for some time now, is being global. G2 didn't start as a global organization. It started with Carlos, as we mentioned, a Spanish influencer. It was a very Spanish first brand that had a lot of Spanish fans, you know. Unique to Europe is the inherent nationalism of traditional sports in Europe, of football in Europe, is, you know, and this doesn't exist. Tribalism exists in college football in particular in the States, but it's not the same, I think, in most other sports. That's my hometown. Yeah. So I'm a Georgia Bulldog fan. There's a Hawks hat behind me for the people that are watching the video version of this.
I was going to the new Falcons stadium, and I was attending the Atlanta FC, like, first game sold out. I've seen that for sure. There's a form of tribalism in US too.
But it doesn't work here in esports, because I think a lot of the esports fans here are fans for different reasons. it seemingly does work in esports in Europe in a lot of different ways. You mentioned K-Corp. Carmine Corp has a huge amount of support from the French fans. And, you know, Koi is the same, have sort of taken up the Spanish mantle. I don't think there's a comp to those two in Germany or England quite yet, though, you know, Germany has a lot of esports fans from looking at the raw numbers. What is the decision? Because it feels almost too easy if you are branding yourself and legitimately have people involved from one nationality. It feels almost too easy to get fans if you are, you know, the French team, the Spanish team, the German team. What has been sort of the emphasis to remain global rather than lean in harder?
I think it's the ambition. I mean, G2 stands for ambitious. We go in final of the major in Stockholm. We lose in final. Change players because second is the first loser, you know? So for sure, if you look at Counter-Strike, there's this idea that with like just one country, it's difficult to win unless you are CIS. And then all teams start to go international to get better talent and to have a chance. Same for League of Legends. So I think we are ambitious, and we decided to not advertise G2 in Spanish or French or German. We do everything in English, so that any story from G2 Gozen to G2 Oya to Rocket League is something that you can share as a fan wherever you come from. Only exception for us is China, where we actually advertise and content in Chinese, but we had an opportunity because the platform are different. So we had to create channels anyway, so let's do it in the local language. That's the only exception, and I think it's a big choice. We decided to be a global brand that addresses our fans globally. If you compare it, like, Real Madrid is not probably the most popular Madrid club of Madrid. Atletico, Getafe are very popular in the city. But globally, Real Madrid is very popular and sometimes the second favorite club of any kid in Europe, you know? The All Blacks, they have a very small country in New Zealand. But if you're a rugby fan, the All Blacks is probably your second favorite team after your national team. I think we go for that. We've also the belief that in esports, we could also be the first one because the nationalism, the patriotic aspect of it is lower by definition. By the way, the teams are structured with less nationalities. Or more nationalities in this case. And so, yeah, that's a bet. That's also the beauty of it. Like, we don't have a stadium. We don't have a story arc that connects us to only Berlin or only Madrid. Let's embrace it. And when in Dallas, we won the major last year in Rocket League, half of the fans were G2. All of them were American. And for them, G2 is an American brand because that's their brand in Rocket League. And I think if we can replicate this in different games and build kind of like this, yeah, sense of belonging, wherever you are part of a G2 army and having some attribute and some way of expressing yourself that is common across all the rosters, I think that's the way we want to build it. Is it easy? Absolutely not, because a Rocket League fan is slightly younger, a Call of Duty fan, a Valorant fan, a League of Legends slightly older. So we need to find the different attributes of each community and try to see how we can experience the G2 brand for them. But we are trying harder, and we are very, you know, we are challengers at heart, so we take this as our biggest challenge.
You mentioned in the answer before that the breakdown of revenues, and you mentioned the skins and the partnerships that you guys have in various different games for virtual goods. I think a lot of the conversation around esports and sustainability on are inside of, you know, esports Twitter, the more like 20,000 some active people that are constantly tweeting about esports on Twitter. A lot of it is, well, the publishers could fix this all tomorrow by just, like, you know, giving a stipend, a bigger stipend, and helping support, etc. You are in a unique position because you're not just the CEO of a major esports team brand now. You previously worked on the business development side of Riot Games and worked in the LEC. And I am curious your thoughts on this because, yeah, that is an easy solution, but I don't personally think that Riot or Activision Blizzard or, you know, Psyonix, etc., like, the agreements they have are fine for them already. They're not really incentivized to give you anything more than what they already give you. I'm curious how you think about that and what is the argument to, you know, I guess two-part question. One, Do you think that they should be supporting the esports teams more than they already are on the publisher side?
No, in my position, you know? No.
Yeah, I figured I wanted to double check. And two, what is the argument? What is the argument to do that, like, in from your position?
I mean, the argument is, like, there's like, no doubt on the value that this kind of, like, esports ecosystem brings to the retention and the loyalty of their player base. Now there's a most likely a question about what is it worth? And for them, and trying to find the balance. A healthy ecosystem is an ecosystem where each part of the ecosystem survive and can live. And so right now, this...
What is it worth, Albon? I'm curious. You've worked on the publisher side of things. What is it worth?
I don't have the details of the numbers, and I'm not sure I will be able to share it now in my position. But I think Riot is investing hundreds of millions of dollars in each of their esports ecosystem. They do it probably for a reason, which is they think this is bringing this value back to their games. So now what I see is that, yes, digital goods is a great avenue, but it's also easier to do when you have 30 teams in Valorant than when you have 300 teams in League of Legends. So there's a question about the right size for the ecosystem to be able for the bag of money available generated by skins to finance the right amount of teams. So I see Rainbow Six, I see Rocket League, I see Valorant, for me, are as future-proof model, future-proof ecosystem with like the right amount of teams, the right amount of revenue sharing. I would never say right amount because I always want more, but I would say going directionally in the right direction. Whereas, for example, League of Legends is probably still a bit too much leagues and still too much teams so that we can all live comfortably in this business. So that would be my point of view.
I want to pivot a little bit to a question from one of our listeners, Ryan Friend, who is one of the writers over at Dust2, the American sister site to HLTV. He had a question related to the Louvre agreements and Blast. And this is relevant to sort of the publisher conversation we're having right now. Valve has come out and said that with the release of Counter-Strike 2, that they are not particularly pro routine franchise leagues. G2 does have partnerships with ESL via the loop.
They decided to forbid it. So in the latest decision from Valve, they decided that from 2025 and beyond, if organizers such as ESL and Blast wants to host long-term leagues or like continuous league and not just tournaments, they will have to cope with like specific regulation that prevent kind of like agreement that we signed between the teams and the organizers. So it's not just a comment, it's an action that they took.
Well, that is Ryan's question, which is, you know, essentially with these partnerships now becoming worthless, which you guys have spent some time in working on the past couple of years with Blast and ESL, how do you all make a recruitment on any of the investments that you've put into developing your Counter-Strike program over the past couple of years, or they just completely avoid?
So first of all, G2 is a very particular situation. We were a founding member of these both agreements. So it's not like we invested financially. We invested in terms of resource and time, but we don't have to recoup. We built rosters and program to be sustainable. We have like some cost of players and staff and support, and we try to generate revenues with like a combination of like what we get from Valve through the digital items, what we get from the tournament organizers through either franchise league with revenue sharing or just like prize money and participation fee, and what we can generate ourselves through fandom engagement like jersey and merch and sponsorship. So that's our job. We have 11 teams. Each team, we look at it very carefully. We try to anticipate some changes. We try to adapt the investment to the right level. We can talk about the LEC and the decision that have been taken by Riot. I think it's good to impermanently try to adapt cost and revenue and see what we can do there. What is the consequence for us? Well, the consequence is we are going to be more dependent of our performance to generate some revenues from the different tournaments. You know, it won't be kind of like a foundation of revenue that allow us to build a facility, have some staff, and not only us, but the whole ecosystem to elevate and create some resource for the players. It sounds like by the decision, Valve says most important thing is the players. They apparently don't see the value of the organization around the players. We do. We believe that performance coach, facilities, team managers, all the administration that we do around them for traveling and supporting and preserving them has some value. And to do that, we need to be able to invest and not just wait to win or not to prize money to survive. That's what I think is the missed opportunity for them to realize. Now, am I worried? Not necessarily. I think we have a competitive advantage with like the amount of partners, sponsors that support G2 to be able to probably invest a bit more than average on competitive rosters, which would guarantee us in average. I mean, G2 is known for high highs and low lows, but in average to participate in most of the tournaments and give us a visibility, give us also the participation to whatever revenue will be shared with the participants to create a successful program. So I'm not scared. I think we're in a good position. Teams with a smaller brand, less sponsors, less legacy would probably be at risk because now every game matters. And if you don't qualify, you're not part of like the revenue pots.
Does it affect the way that you think about spend and the viability of having a top Counter-Strike program and inside of your organization?
No, I think we're not really a fan of participation. We like to win and we like to try to win. So in a major game like League of Legends, Counter-Strike, Valorant, if we get in, we get in to try to win it all.
I want to talk about that because you all have made some news the past 2 weeks of getting back into Valorant, coming into the VCT by adopting the roster that was left behind by the Guard. I want to ask a couple different questions on this. One, I want to ask why you think, without knowing them personally, why do you think the Kroenke family abandoned the Guard and mostly all of esports so aggressively in the past 4 to 5 months?
Honestly, I have no idea. Like, winning the tournament, qualifying for VCT, and not doing it, I have no idea. I mean, I can't figure it out. I try to, you know, you try to be smart, you try to make some assumptions, hypotheses, everything. I didn't see it coming. I really didn't see it coming. And when we lost in the Challenger Series in semifinal against them, my mind immediately went to, okay, what are the other options to go back in VCT? And we started to, you know, you're probably aware, we applied for China. We were talking with like some organization, maybe if we could acquire them. Like, we went all directions to try to get in, but we never, ever assumed that they would not accept the deal. And that the winning team would not accept the deal was honestly not the scenario for us. And so I can't explain it. I'm sorry.
I think what's interesting, I had someone kind of in their orbit of influence say to me that there was a New York Times article at the end of last year about sort of how bad the esports ecosystem was from a return on investment perspective, especially the American teams. And again, the expectations and promises being way higher than the reality could have ever attained. And this person said something to me that stuck with me all year, which is nobody wants to be the most stupid billionaire. And so everyone wants, you know, there are people pulling out, and that's how it works. Like, that's American investment. It's very trend oriented, right? So no one wants to be the last one to pull out and look like an idiot. You'd rather be the first to give up than the last, which is.
But why did they participate in the league then?
That's a good question.
That's what I mean by that. I understand people pull it out if they don't believe in it. I already expressed that I think there's still too many actors, and that's why we all. Some of us are suffering, you know. I think we are probably on the winning side of this equation right now by being, you know, profitable and by building something that is growing and like being on the top tier. We attract more sponsors. Like, there's a positive effect of being on the top right now. But I understand people leaving if they are in the mid-size or they can't figure out a way to build rosters or to monetize it, you know. There are teams that win and have great brand, but they don't have sponsors. And there are people that monetize well, but configure how to win. If you don't get both, you probably miss like a key component of a successful organization, but then don't participate. Like, I didn't get it, you know?
In the absence of the American billionaires, though, I think in their place will come new investors. And one of those new investment groups has been the Saudis. Saudi Arabian Public Investment Fund has made a fairly aggressive level of investment in the esports space over the past year. Acquired ESL Facet Group acquired both of them for a collective $1.5 billion and put them together. Acquired Esports Engine and Vindex as well. And now own a good chunk of the non-publisher ran esports tournament organizers, which with the Valve news, et cetera, seems like a terrible bet, but that's here nor there. One of the things that I remember when I first heard your name and was reporting on is your position and part in doing the NEOM deal during your time at Riot. NEOM, the city that is being built by the Saudis to be like a tourist city, and obviously they want gaming to be a big part of this, which was met with very significant backlash, so much that Riot had to pull out of the deal after it. I want to ask you just straight up how you feel about the moral position of dealing with the Saudi Arabian state, given everything they have done to Jamal Khashoggi and what they do to people from the LGBTQ community, etc., and how you feel about them sort of positioning as saviors to the space and sports washing in general.
So lots in your question, but you know, I'm going to give you a very personal answer then. Like for me, I come from a very old country in a very old continent where like confrontation created a lot of wars. And the time where countries started to work together created the biggest and longest era of peace for Western Europe. So I would just say that working in a sports organization like us, I feel gaming and esports is the space where we have an opportunity to build bridges. So right now, if you look at the world of gaming, probably one of the fastest growing region of the world for gamers, people who wants to play video games, is in the Middle East. I'm not picking one in particular. I think if you go to Qatar, if you go to Egypt, if you go to KSA, there's a lot of young people that wants to play video games. And I'm not surprised that for them, investing into gaming right now is probably a good choice for their transformation from a Petroleum-linked business to something else. If you invest into gaming, securing the meta for loyalty and retention, which is esports, is probably not a bad idea. And yeah, and for organizations like us, playing tournaments that give opportunity to players to play against the best in the world for great competition is a no-brainer. So I don't position it at a moral level. I don't position it as, do I understand what each actor is doing? And I would say yes.
I don't think it will be long before we see an LEC team that is a good chunk owned by the Saudi Arabian state. And I'm curious, if the Saudis came to acquire G2 today and you had 100% voting power and, you know, remove all of your board, remove the Ma family, the owner of the Nets, and remove Jens and remove everyone else, and you had to make this call, do you sell G2 to the Saudi Arabian state?
I mean, as you know, I'm a shareholder, but I would not make a decision. So as a management team, we're not deciding this kind of thing. So I will reserve my answer because I can only say that right now, as part of a management team, I'm very happy to have some shares in G2 because I think this is going to be the best esports club in the world, if it's not already. And we're going to be part of the biggest competitive brand in the world in the future. So I don't want to sell my shares, if it's what you're asking.
I'm just curious the sort of the moral position of all of it, because I think, you know, I have strong opinions about sports washing. I've made them known. That feels very personal, that when, you know, a state kills a journalist.
I understand that not everybody put this at that level. And there are some benefits for the players, for the fans from the region. And we serve them like we serve other region of the world where we play and we entertain, you know? We are 150.
It's the balance of I've always said this when we've talked about the topic, you know, I'm super into pro wrestling as a fan, and pro wrestling is, you know, they're about to do another Saudi Arabian event in the next couple of months, which will be headlined by some of their biggest talent. It's a hard balance of, like, of course the people of the Middle East, of course people from UAE and Saudi Arabia and Qatar, et cetera, they deserve as much opportunity to play video games just as much as anyone else in the world, whether from China, from America, from Europe, et cetera. They deserve as much opportunity and as much say. It's balancing that against the governments, right? That's the hard part. It's like the governments are not good players, you know, and it's not just the Saudis. So with Qatar, like, very documented reporting of what it went to build those World Cup stadiums over the past, you know, 3 years, and using indentured servants from, you know, minority world countries in Southeast Asia and bringing people out to Qatar to build those stadiums. It's a hard balance when that is what, yes, the people of Qatar should have as much opportunity as everyone else, but also the government's taking advantage of people from other parts of the world.
I completely respect your opinion as any opinion, you know, like, this is where, in today's world, some citizens are like taking the moral as a compass for their behaviors and the way they make some decision on their consumption, for example. And some others decide to use functionality of product or benefits of product as a primary decision factor. I think what I would say is that the number one role of esports and the number one role of gaming is to entertain. And that's what I'm here to do. And I don't feel that we are like a governing bodies. I don't feel like we are like judging or in a position to judge anyone. And therefore we focus on that. That's our role in the ecosystem, you know?
I want to end on this about the future of this ecosystem, because this is the number one question I don't think anyone has the answer to. And so everyone that comes on this show, I ask a very similar question, is how do we fix it, right? How do we make this sustainable, the esports industry sustainable? Because it's not today. This is everything we've talked about in this conversation is a direct result of problem solving and how someone like yourself and someone like myself in the power positions that we are in think about our contribution to problem solving. And I'm curious how you think that we get to a world where this is a sustainable, remove attaining the goals of the NFL or attaining the goals of the Premier League or all the shit that was indexed 5-6 years ago, with just making a sustainable sports business.
It took them 100 years. We are 8 years old, so we have a bit of time to be at that level. No, I mean, look, I think the revenues are very talked about, and I think we don't talk enough about, you know, having a bit more disciplined organization on the cost. So I think, for example, the measures that Riot is presenting us for the LEC would be very impactful for an organization like G2. I'm not going to mention a number now, but we are slightly above the luxury tax level that has been presented to us. It's going to take us probably several seasons to get there. And in between, likely we'll have to pay something to the community of LEC. And I think it's great. I think if we all have a bit more discipline around what it takes to compete, to be more in line with what the competition is generating, I think it's positive. Obviously, I believe that, you know, publisher could share a bit more with us, but they spend so much money already. So when I see the debate about should we have one roadshow, two roadshows, three roadshows, how many roadshows do we need to create a competition? I was there during COVID, where we were playing from bedrooms and having casters like pushing their heart out to just create a show out of like mouse and keyboard. And fans were there to watch because we created a show that they wanted to continue watching, you know? So I'm not saying we should go back to the online Twitch level of esports, but I think we probably don't need to be the NBA every day. We could be the NBA once per year with a world championship and then create some narrative and continuity with a bit of low-key content. I mean, like, our most successful content right now is TikTok. Spoiler, it's not the most expensive one to produce. So I think we have a bit more discipline there to balance the both side of the equation. It's probably as important as driving new revenues, milking the fans. The fans give us their attention and their passion. We should pay them for that, you know? So I when people say, hey, how are you going to monetize the fans? They give us already more than what we need, which is their passion, their attention. So let's try other ways, like with publishers, maybe we can talk to the fans that play video games for the skins and not just the fans that watch, you know, and the partners. And maybe we can create product that they want to carry outside of just watching esports, but also in their day-to-day. Yeah, that would be my suggestion, is to a bit more discipline. And for that, we need to think a bit collectively how to do it together. When there's like outliers that overspend everybody, play with the agent to double the salaries, that doesn't help. So let's try to find a solution there to be a bit more, you know, responsible as organizers.
Well, I thank you for being a good sport and joining us here on the pod. I'm sure we'll have you back sometime in the future. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
That's all for our show. If you enjoyed this episode of Visionaries, you can find more like it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcast. And while you're there, consider giving us a review. It really helps other people find the show. And if you want to support us directly at Overcome and you appreciate the work that we do, you can now join our Patreon, which is linked in the show notes. We have a range of benefits for our patrons, including special episodes of Visionaries and access to the video version of Visionaries. This episode was produced by Cecilia Ciocchetti. Our digital media intern is Beverly Perez. Special thanks to Prem Thottamkara and Sammy Daig for their help with this episode. We'll see you here next week on Visionaries.